Welcome back to Dangerous Rhetoric, everyone. This is episode 102. Before I jump into it, I will kindly remind everyone to please like, comment, share, subscribe, and throw money at us if you want to help us keep doing this, because we're, you know, a bunch of grifters and right-wing streamers. Sorry, far-right-wing streamers, according to Antifa. Yeah.
We got doxxed.
Yeah, they tried to dox us. They didn't dox us.
A little baby doxing.
Yeah, I was telling Matt about that last weekend. Mm-hmm. But with all of that said, today we are joined by another very special guest, Matt Palumbo, who is the author of his recent book, The Man Behind the Curtain Inside the Secret Network of George Soros, which came out in 2021, as well as Dumb and Dumber, How Cuomo and de Blasio Ruined New York, because they did. Debunk This, Shattering Liberal Lies, Spygate. And he has a recent book coming out called Fact Checking the Fact Checkers, How the Left Hijacked and Weaponized the Fact Checking Industry. And Matt also is a content manager for Bongino Report. Matt, thank you for joining us.
No, yeah, thanks for having me on. It was great meeting you guys the other week, too.
Yes, no, I had a lot of fun conversing with you at that birthday party. You were probably the most engaging guest that...
No, it's good to hear. With.
Besides Libby Edmonds, Libby's always great to talk to. She's awesome.
Yeah. It was a cool bar, too, because they had, like, no real electricity in there, so it was like we're in the 1800s, yes. Like a club or something, but it was very cool.
It was dimly lit. They had, like, the paintings all over the walls.
Yeah.
Old-style furniture. That place was great. I really enjoyed the party. But let's just jump right into the meat and potatoes of everything. So you have a recent book out on... Mm-hmm. George Soros. So we're going to probably mostly talk about that.
He's my favorite Sith Lord.
He's your favorite Sith Lord. He does look like one.
I mean, he looks like a Sith Lord.
I mean, seriously, you look at the guy and you're like, this dude looks like not a good dude. I still can't believe he's still alive. The guy's freaking 92.
Well, the saying is only the good die young. Yeah. So he's another 100 years of this guy. And it is funny how... Like, you're taught as a kid, don't judge a book by its cover. But I got to be honest, the past 10, 20 years of my life, it's the best possible way to judge someone. Like, when I worked at Dunkin' Donuts, but before they even fully walked in the door, I'm like, you're a problem. I already know. And 99% of the time, they were a problem. So with Soros, he looks evil, sounds evil, talks evil. Therefore, Occam's razor would suggest the guy is not a good dude.
Yeah, sometimes I think it's very appropriate to judge books by their covers.
Yeah.
So what got you interested in George Soros? When did he first pop up on your radar? And when did you decide, like, I'm going to write a book about this guy?
There are a lot of things where, like, I'll just read a lot about a topic and then... Like, when you know nothing about a topic, you just sort of trust anyone's judgment. So just after many, many years of reading random things about Soros, I just kind of caught on, like... Well, some of these seem like really far-stretched things. However, I think people are kind of generally on the right track of, like, it's objectively true that he's spending all these billions of dollars, but in literally every comment section ever, he's getting blamed for something. So I'm like, well, the truth is somewhere in between of he's spending tens of billions of dollars influencing things to quite literally everything going wrong is him. And, you know, as I said to Lou Dobbs, I'm like, even to be fair, though, even the most unhinged conspiracies are sort of directionally correct. So, I mean, yes, he might not literally be giving Black Lives Matter a check to burn down a city, but he's giving hundreds of groups that have an identical ideology tens of millions of dollars, and we know what they do with the money. So it's one of those things where, like, a fact checker could say, well, you know, this claim is not 100% true, but you really go through it and you go, okay, this is 98% true. So... It just kind of stuff. Like, I wanted to sort of sort out what's true and what's not. And I kind of knew early on, it was like, I have enough research where I can just prove what's real. So there's no need to exaggerate when we have all of this evidence. And then one of the things, too, at the end of the book is I just have a list of every organization I could find that he gave to. And it's probably already out of date by now. Just as a sort of glossary, just to go, okay, who, you know, this name sounds familiar. Let me see if it's Soros tied. And sort of the way I say he has influence is a lot of it's just sort of like an implicit or implied contract. Like when you give money to someone, especially if it's a political organization or like these DAs, like it's not like Soros is calling them up and going, hey, I just saw some murderer stab someone, make sure they get out of jail.
Yeah.
He knows who these people are because they campaign and you can tell from their campaign, oh, these people are insane. So that alone, you just give them the money and it's almost like outsourcing. Everything's kind of on autopilot. Or is he giving money to a think tank?
So you don't have to
tell them, hey, FYI, if you find anything negative on me, don't report it. It's just an implied, okay, we all know how this works. So that's kind of
bite the hand that
the way I go about the how he's influencing people.
You don't bite the hand that feeds. So
exactly.
You don't think he's part of the Illuminati.
I mean, if there is one, he probably is, to be fair, but it's not in the book.
That didn't come up in his research,
huh? Yeah. People are like, is he a blood-sucking reptilian? I'm like, listen, I haven't disproven it, but I'm not going to go out there and, you know, destroy my credibility.
Totally. Yeah, I've been following your article series.
Thank you.
In your posts, and I found them very enlightening, very scary. Mm-hmm. I have always sort of known in the back of my mind that George Soros was one of these like shady billionaires, mm-hmm. like, you know, doing the financial puppeteering around the world. And when I read your articles, it really sort of resolved everything. You know, you give names, dates, mm-hmm. Dollar amounts and organizations, which I think is huge. When you just realize the sheer volume of people that he funds and organizations that he funds, it's an insane laundry list that does boggle the mind. I was going through it. I'm just like, I had to take a break. I was like, there's just too much here.
He has his hand in a lot.
Well, there's one that just came to mind. I think I did one about his influence of the whole fact-checking thing.
Yes.
And I remember when I was, so this was completely independent. When I was researching the book in it after that, which I'm sure we'll get into, when I was Googling like Soros' name, I got a targeted ad in the Google results from PolitiFact. And it was like one of those things where they set up a straw man about him to knock him down. But I didn't realize later on he's funded PolitiFact's parent company. And then I was like, you know what? Let me just search Soros' name on PolitiFact. I think there's 36 articles. There's not a single one criticizing him. It's either like to go, no, he's not funding that. He's actually funding human rights and whatever. Or just like, you know, they'll debunk something purposely ridiculous, like, you know, Soros is a sex slave in his basement. And it's like, well, okay, no one actually believes that. But you just wrote the article to then go to portray the enemies, his opponents as crazy.
Yeah.
So it's just one example that came to mind of his influence. But the funny thing with the Post series was I wrote the series and they never told me it was for the front cover. So I just submitted it thinking like, all right, I'll go up on the website the next day. So I wake up to like all these text messages, like, I'm really proud of you. And I'm looking at it. I'm like, it was from someone who works like down the street from me. And I'm like, all right, that's cool. Like, I don't know why you're proud of me, but you know, I appreciate this random message from this person I haven't heard from in 3 months, like just stuff like that. And then I realized, of course, after that, oh wait, they made it the front story. And it was a really cool experience. Talking about it with everyone. So
I remember you mentioning to me too, there was a response in a sense from Soros. Right?
Oh yeah. So it's funny too, because his Twitter feed was like one tweet every 3 months he would send. And now ever since the Post article series I went up, every single day he sends at least one. So I don't know if it's just he thought like, well, I'll have to be doing more on this platform to get my message out. But some VP at the Open Society Foundation did like a 20-tweet thread attacking me that didn't really address me. And then I went through the quote tweets, and it was so obvious, like an email blast went out that was like, all right, guys, we got to support Laura, whatever her name was, but she's getting owned on Twitter by Palumbo's friends. So there was one guy who, it's like, you know, Matt Palumbo spreading conspiracies about Soros, and the name sounded familiar. I'm like, I swear to God, the name was familiar. So I Google the name. It's this guy was just in the news for a week prior because there was White House records. He had been to the White House, the Biden White House 13 times so far.
Oh my.
So he was accusing me of spreading conspiracies about Soros' reach and influence in the White House. And he has visited them more than 2 dozen times. And it was just revealed a week before he was criticizing me. So it was stuff like that. And like, they weren't even good at trolling. Like, someone would write, like, it would be like some like academic at Harvard, like, great thread by Laura, and I'm a dick. So I'd write back, like, no, it's not, you suck. And they would, like, write back, like, a 10-year-old as well. And I'm like, come on, like, you gotta, don't stoop to my level. But, it was a good experience with all that. And the thing is, too, about I don't know if people know this, but on Twitter, you can set up your settings so you don't see tweets by people you don't follow. Mm-hmm. So I just don't see any of the criticism anyway, so I just don't care. But more people should probably do that.
Yeah, my page is set to that.
So. Like I accidentally, because I saw my post, my response saying, like, this sucks, and there's, like, 300 responses, so I'm like, all right, it's not good. So I click, and of course, they're all telling me to kill myself. But, you know, I got the gist, basically, and got on with my day.
Right.
Very nice, tolerant people.
whatever. Yeah, just to be expected at this point. If you all have 12 followers, I really just don't care.
Well, buy, you know, fake tweeters.
Yeah, well, it was weird because it looked coordinated in that they sent out the thread criticizing me. Bongino saw it and, like, wrote something mocking them, and then all his followers attacked them. So for a while, the whole comment section was just people mocking them. And then it looked like an email went out where all these accounts were just kind of, like, it was, someone would retweet it and be like, yeah, I love working at the Open Society Foundation. And it was all, like, these sort of cult-like, I love my job and we're not evil kind of tweets. So I just assumed there was an email that went out that was like, hey, guys, we need to do some PR, this article series, if you wouldn't mind doing this. I can't prove any of this, but it seems very much like that.
Rally the troops.
Well, we know they do that.
But you see it at, like, I can't remember if it was the New York Times or the Washington Post. Whenever there's a scandal, the all employees will all, like, in unison tweet, like, or no, what I'm thinking of, there was a report that Kamala Harris is, like, horrible, impossible to work for. And then within, like, 12 hours of that report getting published, every person who works for her was, like, had some vague tweet of, like, boy, another great day of working for VP Harris. God, do I love the perks of working for her. But it was so, there were like 3 minutes apart. And I'm like, come on, like, we all know what you're doing. Yeah. But it was like that for Soros, kind of.
Well, see, you say that. You say we all know. We know what they're doing.
But yeah.
The people that aren't, like, you know, engrossed in media 24/7 and terminally online, they have no clue.
Correct. Right? But it is, people really do this at publications. They will tell their employees to, for PR reasons, to act like everything's fine, which has the opposite impact, really, when you look at it.
Yeah, because it just makes them look like, you know, fakes.
Something to hide, yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Matt, do you know, I think I knew at one point, but now I forget, how did George Soros originally make all his millions and billions?
Well, it's mainly hedge funds, you know, just taking investor money and turning it into more money. So there's, on paper, it looks like he's very good at it. I think in terms of, like, it returns from inception, starting his hedge fund, I think he's second in world history after Ray Dalio in terms of return on investment. It was something like, you know, I think it was $1 million when he started his fund. It's worth more than $1 billion today, or it might have been $2 billion. I have the exact numbers in the book. But now, to be fair, that's a 50-year period, but still a 1,000 to 2,000x return over the years is unprecedented. He has been accused of insider trading on multiple occasions and convicted of it in I think it was French court. It was like a fine he had to pay, but he has been proven he's insider traded before. He's meddled in internal affairs where, you know, I have nothing against betting against companies, but there was a very infamous case in London where he bet against the pound and then did some financial engineering to basically ensure that it would crash. So, there's a difference between thinking, hey, something's going to happen and I'm going to place a bet versus placing a bet and then causing it to happen. Other than, you know, there are Asian financial markets as well where he's been accused of doing the same thing and betting against currencies and then taking action to catalyze their collapse. So,
wow.
So there are things like that. Now, he could also be just, listen, I'm sure his portfolio also could do well on its own, but there are also these little things along the way. And then also he has political connections. So there is a sort of, you know, insider trading aspect of that knowledge. And I'm trying to think of examples where he's, or an example that comes to mind is when a lot of post-Soviet countries are going capitalist, you have this phenomenon where they have tens of billions of dollars in formerly state-owned assets, and there's the question of what do we do with all of them? And many of these countries did the wrong thing, which was sell them to oligarchs for pennies on the dollar, who were very well connected to the Russian elites, and Soros had connections, and was able to buy up all these assets for very, very cheap, and then turn them for a profit. Now, the Open Society Foundation's account of that is, oh, he was helping these countries become capitalist because he loves capitalism. Clearly betrayed by all his other options, or all his other actions out there in the world, but that's their spin on it. But no, he was had a lot of was very benefited pretty much there, and also too helped. It was part of a transition team that Clinton helped set up during those years as well. So he was very, very ingrained in those countries, and I'm sure could use his influence as he does today.
Word, yeah. Well, that's one way to make your money if you got all those connections and you know what's coming down the pike. It helps
for real.
And then I read your other article about the district attorneys, which was especially crazy. Disturbing.
Yeah.
40 million, it says here.
The 75 people, 40 million, which is, I mean, in terms of bang for his buck, I think the most actual impact, because there are presidential cycles where he's dumped hundreds of millions quite literally for nothing. And it used to be people like Obama he backed and then complained he didn't get enough influence. So he had not not for Cuban as Obama, but it seemed like Obama was like, you know what, I'll take your money and then you can screw off. Which, yeah, you know, whatever, I'll give him that, I guess. But in these DAs, and as I said earlier, like, they are completely insane people. And in the book, the way I set it up is, here's what they campaigned on, and the significance of that is, you know, anyone doing anything knew what they were getting themselves in for. Here's the actual policy change, and then here's the consequence, and it's a disaster everywhere. It is really, their philosophy is that criminals are somehow the real victims in any situation. And if you are a criminal, God, there must, in the timeline of your life, there must have been one thing we could pinpoint that went wrong that caused this whole butterfly effect. And whatever it is, it's our fault. And that's the philosophy. So if it, you know, if someone stole something, well, it's our fault they had to resort to that because, you know, woe is them. And, you know, this sort of philosophy, like when Jesus was saying, love the poor and you know, all the, you know, the things he said about the rich, that was at a time period in history where 99.9% of all people were poor. So right, there's really not much of a moral judgment you can make when quite literally everyone is poor. When you're in the richest country in the world and you are poor, listen, there are people who obviously hit a very bad string of luck that is kind of like the equivalent of losing 50 blackjack hands in a row. But what we know from the actual homeless population and most criminals is most of them are on drugs or alcoholics. And it is to the point where not one person in their life has said, you know what, I'm going to give you a chance and take you in and see if you can turn your life around. Maybe, and a lot of them, I'm sure, do need that chance, but there are just a lot of people where it's not a case of you were denied an opportunity. It is, unfortunately, your decisions have let you here. And, you know, I'm all for anything that can help them help themselves, but an unfortunate reality is, and this has been documented, you can go to people in Kensington and say, do you want treatment? And every single one says no. You can go to San Francisco and say, do you want housing? And almost 100% say no. So it is, listen, if the solution was just give more money and that actually worked, I would say, you know what? I'll abandon my conservative values. Just give them the money. But it doesn't work. So there's no point. And you know, they do this whole sort of root cause analysis of crime of, oh, it's got to be poor education or not enough opportunities and all this stuff. And the real root cause is crime, unfortunately, in today's day and age. And another important point is you have to understand that, like, if crime doubles in a city, it's usually not because there's twice as many criminals or the circumstances have changed to create twice as many criminals. It's probably the same number of criminals committing twice as many crimes because they get away with it. Yeah. There was a case in San Francisco where I think it was last year where 100% of the increase in hate crimes against Asians was attributable to one person. It was one guy who's wow, made dozens and dozens and dozens of attacks. Jesus. And when that's the case, like, there's a ripple effect to crime. So by not having bail, that creates a ripple effect where, okay, granted, these people are going to do it anyway, but maybe there's at least a week or two where they're not committing crimes.
So that's the thing.
And, you know, it sucks when there's a case of, like, you know, someone stole $3 and we got to put him in jail and await on bail. Like, the optics look bad, but listen, to be tough on crime, there are going to be some cases where we go, all right, maybe we're a little too tough, but the reverse is so much worse. So that's, you know, why we have to imprison people. And El Salvador is a country that did the exact opposite of what we're doing now, where for most of their since I think the 80s and 90s, their murder rate was like triple what Chicago's was. And that's a national average. So when you hear, like, you know, and even in Chicago, at least it's concentrated in certain pockets. When your murder rate nationally is triple that, like, just an average place in daytime is like Chicago. Just an average. So it is incomprehensible for us. And so far in the first 2 months of the year, their murder rate is like a quarter of what ours is. So they went from three times Chicago to a quarter of our national average. Well, what did they do? They imprisoned a hell of a lot of people and started enforcing the law. And that's really all it took. Now, there are human rights abuses in the way they did it. They imprisoned 2% of the population, a bit more extreme than anything we do here. But it's, you know, as I said, directionally, the thing you got to do is you increase the law and order, and what do you know, crime goes down. And it worked really well for them. And I don't see any civilians complaining. So,
yeah, you mentioned bail policies. I was just reading an article today about the zero bail policies in California. And they just put a study out. It was Yolo County District Attorney Jeff Riesing. And they found that those who posted bail those who were let out with low or no cost bail, they reoffended more often.
I think three times as much or something.
It was something like that. They were accused of 200 times more violent crimes. Mm-hmm. And the numbers were crazy. Like, the study found that suspects released without bail were rearrested 163% on 163% more charges than those who posted bail, and they reoffended 70% more often. Those reoffenses resulted in felony charges 90% more often, and they were accused of three times as many violent crimes. And the policies are a complete failure.
Yeah.
But as Brent was, I was talking to him about this earlier, and he said, well, actually, if this was what they were intending to do, then you could argue that the policies were actually successful.
Well, that's the thing too. Like, they never publicly acknowledge it. I mean, there are a few cities that defunded police that have reversed the defunding.
Yeah.
But what's the most notable of that is not one of them publicly acknowledged it. Like, the city council wasn't like, all right, well, we're going to be increasing the police budget to that disaster. It was just cut the budget, total chaos. Then they went, all right, well, ideologically, we need to have this facade of we're against cops. But now we're realizing we actually need cops. So what do we do? All right, I guess we fund the police and hope no one notices. And that's basically the route a few went, where they were like, they wouldn't admit. It was weird because they're doing the right thing, but know that admitting they're doing the right thing will be worse in their situation because their constituents are crazy.
Yeah.
But there's two elements I found that are very important to reducing crime. And obviously the level of punishment is important. But what's actually more important, or seems to matter a little bit more, is just the probability of getting caught. Because, like, there's evidence that, like, for instance, like, you know, very strict drug laws don't prohibit, like, teenagers from dealing drugs because, A, they don't think they're going to get caught, and B, they don't even know what the law is. So it has no effect. So you need to actually make sure that when people commit a crime, there's a high probability they're going to take them off the street. And the sort of irony of the bail reform is it's going, all right, we're going to catch you. By the way, just kidding, have a nice day. So it's they're going the first step. They're going, we're taking off the street, and then going, all right, see you later. There was a Soros DA, I think it was Buddha Bibaraj, where part of her diversionary program was, like, if you had a misdemeanor, you could watch a video about why you shouldn't commit crime, and that there are consequences, and what the consequences are, and then you wouldn't have to face consequences. And I'm like, but that's just teaching them there's no consequence.
Yeah,
like, just crazy stuff like that. Like,
how could you expect that crime would go down when you're not punishing?
And these people are incompetent in other areas too. So one of the things that happens with these DAs is, I mean, Republican or Democrat, most people who work in law enforcement want to enforce the law. So when they will take over an attorney's office, they will fire everyone, and it's usually like, you know, combined 200 years of experience gone. And they will hire people who have never tried a murder case or are just new attorneys. And it's like, all right, let's just have college grads run Law and Order. And it's like, even their insane ideology aside, you still have the least qualified people running it. I mean, there was a case with Buddha Bibaraj, who I just mentioned, where, like, there was a name screw up where a murderer, they just let out of jail just because they mixed up a name. And then, of course, had to go get the guy. But just wacky little things like that where what was it? I think there was one case, I might be butchering it a bit, where, like, someone was accused of domestic violence. So they sent in he sent in someone pretending to be his girlfriend who he abused to then testify the charges should be dropped. But it wasn't the same woman. It was just some random person he paid, and they dropped the charges. I'm screwing up a detail in my version. I have the whole one in the book, but that's the general setup of it. It was something like that, where that's how the guy got off. So it's just these people are completely incompetent. And as I said, ideology aside, even if there was no politics, they're still replacing qualified people with morons. So what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, there's a lot of replacement happening too with police chiefs across the
country.
A lot of them are retiring, so there's just new leadership that's stepping in. And there's also staff shortages across the entire country.
And too, we saw with, I think it was it Kansas City, the Tyre Nichols beating, or Memphis? Whatever the city was, I think two or three of the officers, whatever the city was, two or three of the officers were hired after they lowered their hiring standards in the George Floyd riots. And the thing, I mean, the irony of the Defund the Police movement is the cops that are most likely to leave are the good ones. It's the ones who are like, I'm going to do the right thing, but God forbid I got to make a split second decision in 0.001 seconds that could look bad out of context. Yep. I need a police chief and a DA and a mayor who's going to have my back.
Yep.
And they're going to, you know what? I'm not taking that risk.
Yeah.
And it's ironically the worst cops that are going to stick around and who are going to cause more problems. And then it's going to be this infinite cycle of, we have bad cops, we need to defund the cops, and then the good ones leave, so we have bad cops, we need to defund the cops, and it never ends.
Yeah, there was a new bill recently proposed in Oregon to raise the police education requirements.
Mm-hmm.
So basically pushing back against this trend now of lowering the requirements. Yeah. And part of that is because the staff shortages, I think that's why they're lowering the requirements. Yeah. And why do we have staff shortages? Well, that career, being a police officer, is becoming more and more unappealing as a career choice.
And it's only in America.
Police when there are riots across the country in 2020, you know, and who the hell is going to want to step in and do that sort of job? That's why a lot of them are leaving, and a lot of people who may have wanted to do that are changing their mind and doing something else instead.
Yeah, well, I'll be honest. There are police brutality videos I've seen where I'm like, I would have been worse.
Sure.
Like, and I don't mean the actual egregious ones. I just mean one where, like, the guy's seriously resisting. It's a 30-minute ordeal, and he gets a punch. Where I'm like, I'm honestly surprised there's not more violence in the profession relative to what there is. And the thing everyone misses when they say, like, well, these European countries don't have all these shootings. And I'm like, well, in Europe, the criminals generally aren't riding around with guns in their cars. So there's no – the probability of someone pulling a gun on you is – closer to zero than it is in this country. So you just have to have it in the back of your mind. And listen, we have hundreds of millions of police encounters a year. There's 1,000 shootings. There are YouTube channels that FOIA every shooting, and you can go watch them yourself. 99% of the cases, a gun's drawn, and what do you think is going to happen? In a lot of these unarmed police shootings, the guy's reaching for the gun. And then there are the dozen cases a year where we can collectively go, what the hell was that about? But that's not, it just does not cross this threshold to defund the police. And their standard of evidence is deliberately, so as long as there's one questionable police shooting, the whole system is rotten. And that's just an absurd standard. Like, if you were, I remember learning in a supply chain class, like, you know, if 99.99% of mail was delivered by USPS, how much would go missing? And it's in the millions of pieces per year just because of the volume. So when you have hundreds of millions of police calls a year and we have 12 shootings that are questionable, it's actually a lot more impressive than you think.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I was definitely one of these people when I was younger who was just very quick to criticize police action.
Me too. But they
should have done this, or you know, they shouldn't have acted this way.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until like experiencing actual violence myself, being in violent altercations. And I think I mentioned this to you too last weekend. I read books by an author called Rory Miller. Mm-hmm. He was a corrections officer, so he's dealt with some of like the most violent, dangerous people that you can think of. Yeah. And, you know, in his book, he talks about how your brain chemistry changes during violent altercations. It warps your perception of time and how fast violence is. It's fast. So it's easy to comment as an armchair commentator about
watching a video.
Yeah, watching a video.
Weeks later.
Yeah.
Why didn't they
have no experience with actual violence and how quick it can be?
And they're so unreal. Like, not only is your adrenaline running, where your thoughts aren't even really thoughts. It's like concepts. But like, they'll be like, why didn't they just pull out the gun and then do a 360 kick and shoot them in the hand? I'm like, okay, go to a shooting range, point a gun forward at the target and pull the trigger. You're not even going to see where the bullet goes. Like, it's so much harder than you think if you've never done it. And listen, like, I was sort of in the same camp as you, but like, I guess to be consistent, like, whenever someone tries to Monday morning quarterback my job with like writing, I'm like, who the hell are you? So I can't even imagine what it's like when you're actually in danger and having to do that stuff when I have like basically a fake job, and even I'm getting pissed off about it. So, you know, anyway, the whole policing environment is such that in Europe, there's like 30 to 50% more cops per capita than we have. So anyone saying we should defund cops is starting from a point where we should probably double them. Like it's just they're already, you know, we're already in the wrong direction. They're calling for a cut atop of a deficit, basically.
Yeah, I think the rational approach is, you know, we address each case, case by case. When there's an actual incident of real police brutality, you know, we call it out, we say what's wrong, and we try to figure out how do we
punish the officers or charge them with crimes, and that's that.
But this blanket approach of just demonizing all police officers, it's like, yes, I get it, they're the state, and the state can definitely be turned against the people, and we got to be careful with that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, they are human beings. You know, I have family who are cops, I know other cops, like, there are people behind that badge and that uniform, and people are flawed, like, they will make mistakes.
Yeah, the thing too is, like, the narrative never changes. So, like, the utility to the left, like with Mike Brown, was hands up, don't shoot. And I read the DOJ, like some of the court docs, and one of the witnesses, who was an African American witness, his direct quote was, "I would have shot the young kid sooner." And I'm going, well, if that's what the black guys who are right there watching it are saying, is my only thing differently is I would have killed him sooner. I'm going, it's probably not a race issue at this point. But there's just little nuggets like that where no one gets to hear them. They'll still say that, or Trayvon Martin. We're with Trayvon Martin. It's like, listen, it could have been bad, but ultimately we have no idea. Like, there's no video camera, so I have absolutely no opinion because I don't have any clue what happened. But it's to the point too where, like, there are cases where someone can be lunging at a cop with a knife and get shot in this protest. So there's just the logic is really going outside the window, and it's they've created their own world where any police shooting can never be justified.
Yeah, if people want a really, I love recommending books on the show, by the way, but if people want a really good overview, a solid, detailed, factual overview of the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman incident and case, read this book, Deadly Force, Understanding Your Right to Self-Defense by Massad Ayoub. Excellent book. And he has a whole section in there where he goes through the entire case and he basically, you know, proves why Zimmerman was technically in the right. It was a self-defense shooting,
and I assume
down to, like, the picture they used for propaganda of this younger Trayvon Martin as a kid.
Yeah, he was 12 years. Everyone's 12 years younger whenever there's a
he
shooting.
He was like 18, and he was huge. He was a big guy. So
even with, like, the Tamir Rice shooting, which was clearly a catastrophic mistake, they use a photo. I mean, he was 12 years old, and they would still use a photo from when he's six. And not only that, he was 6'3" at 12. So from the cop's perspective, I only mention that because from the cop's perspective, it probably didn't look like a 12-year-old. He probably just saw, well, you're six, you're probably not. It's the percent of 12-year-olds that are 6'3" is just very low.
So I had the same exact BB gun that Tamir Rice had.
And it looks like a gun.
It looks like a gun.
Yeah, yeah. It's tragic what happened. He shouldn't have been playing with it, and he did not deserve what happened, but... If you put his gun next to a regular gun and told a person, like, it's 50-50, do you take the shot? It's going to be a mind-racking experience. You would not know what to do in that situation.
Don't they usually have a tip on them that's, like, orange or whatever?
They do. They should, but this one didn't.
So that one doesn't have it on there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know. I mean, it is unfortunate. Yeah, the Tamir Rice case is unfortunate.
And his mother said, too, Black Lives Matter has completely exploited the situation. Like, they'll raise money on his death. And she's like, I haven't gotten anything from these people.
She didn't get any of it.
Yeah. And that's another one of the ironies, too. So her mother opposes Black Lives Matter. Trayvon Martin's mother opposes defund the police. And I think George Floyd's family at least spoke out against the rioting, if not the defund the police movement, too. So it's a lot of the martyrs for these movements, their families are saying the opposite. They're going, no, don't use it for this. And there's no regard for them at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one thing that really we need to think about is that when we defund the police, you get the lowest common denominator, you get worse outcomes. And we've seen it. We've run the experiment. We know what happens. What we haven't tried is upping the standards, what few cases where you do up the standards, it looks like things come out a lot better.
Yeah, and also it harms mostly those poorer communities that these activists are claiming to want to help. Yeah. And in the end, they're the ones who end up getting hurt.
How does this benefit George Soros? Yeah. Like, why would they want to do this? I just don't get it. Is it just because they're so naive and wealthy, like, that they just think that this is, you know, going to lead us to utopia, or is there a more sinister happening here?
Why do you think George Soros is pushing society in this direction?
Well, it's a tough question to answer. I mean, I would say as a whole, the left has a very long history of completely destroying things and then blaming the opposite ideology. Like, I'm not kidding you. If you go to San Francisco and ask them who's to blame for their problems, they blame Republicans. And I'm like, where? Where are they? Like, which one? Where? Like, that, you ever, like, you notice that too with, like, the people who most think, like, that we're a white supremacist country and there's racism around the corner are all people who like live in the most diverse urban environments where these people would obviously not be welcome. So everyone, I don't know, people have these weird misperceptions, but it's sort of go on a tangent. I just have to assume it's just, he must see some sort of utility in chaos in that you can justify more government intervention the worse things are. So, I mean, I think a federalized police force would be a horrible idea because they have no connection to the local community. So, but there are a lot of Democrats in Congress who, not explicitly, but have sort of tried to pay homage or have some sort of support for defund the police, who are also in favor of like the FBI and federalizing police and CIA. So it's like, so you're not really anti-police. And you kind of see them the opposite with the right, where like, we're all for our local police, but we're not for like the FBI and CIA. So it's like, so it's not just police. There's something else going on here. And for us, it's like, well, these local cops have an attachment. They're good. The ones who have no connection to us are, see us as the enemy. And they're supporting the ones who see us as the enemy, but not the ones that are part of the community. So it's just a weird dynamic. And I mean, the Occam's razor answer is just he's an evil guy who wants to do evil. But as for the exact, what is the precise benefit, it's a tougher question. But, you know, it must just be a sort of if there's enough chaos, people will kind of tolerate anything. You saw it in COVID. There was enough fear where people thought that this virus would be strong enough to kill everyone, but not bypass fabric I bought at Walmart. Like, it's just wacky stuff. So
that it can't go around a plastic wall.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you put your mask on when you're walking to your table and then take it off, you're still
And here's the thing. Even if the mask did work, the whole justification was, we're going to get COVID eventually, so we need to, we don't want to overwhelm the hospital. So this was the narrative of the first 2 weeks of COVID. But we don't want to overwhelm the hospital. So, you know, if you can delay getting it, you take everyone who's going to get it, you stretch the curve, and hospitals can accommodate everyone.
Flatten the curve.
That was the logic. Yep. But we're all going to get it eventually, and we have the vaccine. Whether you know, and the people, it, the irony is the people who are still masking are the most pro-vaccine. So, but they are then thus the least pro-vaccine, but they don't really think it works. But like, do you not think you're going to get COVID for the next 60 years? Like, I just don't understand what the point is. Because you're going to get it.
It doesn't make any sense. I saw a lady, I still see, you know, we are close to the college over here and the hospital. So there's a lot of young people and a lot of people coming out of the hospital are always wearing masks. I was so fired up yesterday. I was making TikTok videos, or was it the day before? And I saw a woman coming down the street towards me. I was walking my dog and she didn't have a mask on, but her child had one of those little like masks.
No.
And I wasn't able, it just came up and I was just like, COVID's over, take off the mask. And I just kept walking.
I will, to piss people off, I'll say things I don't even believe. I'll be like, if I mention COVID in front of a liberal, I'll be like, COVID, which was definitely real, hoping they think I'm being sarcastic. So like, they're nuts. I was in San Francisco, and I laughed every time it happened. Me walking into an elevator, it was like the equivalent of if I dropped a fart. It cleared out. I was walking maskless, and four people within 3 seconds would just leave.
Oh my God.
No one would say anything. They just leave. And I'm like, this isn't your floor, because you were waiting before I walked in.
Yeah.
I would laugh, and I would get no reaction, but it was so funny.
That's.
I don't know where I'm going with this, but.
These people are broken.
I had a friend who told me he kind of misses that period a bit, because when he would go to the grocery store, when they finally lifted the mask mandate, a lot of people were still wearing them. So every time he would go in the store, people would clear space around him. And he's like, it's great. I have plenty of space to move around. Because
speaking of super, another thing. So I had my former roommate was African-American. And after the week after George Floyd's death, the white guilt was out of control. Like, we were walking to the supermarket, people would like clear out of his way like he's Moses, and just random people were apologizing to him.
Oh my God.
And he's just like, I don't know for why, but thank you. It was a surreal experience. It was as if he was God for a day. And I'm like, we should milk this. You should totally milk this for as long as.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, remember the politicians were doing that whole thing where they were wearing the African
thing,
and they were kneeling and making a big show. Yeah.
See, I think this kind of ties into the question we asked, you know, why is Soros doing this? And it's like, it's a divide and conquer strategy. Like, they want to turn the races against each other. They want to turn people against the police and the police to fear the people, et cetera, et cetera. And just people are easier to control when they're not unifying against you, when they're fighting with each other. It's an age old strategy of war. It's not a new thing.
Well, that's the irony of their whole intersectional strategy of, like, you know, it's white men versus the world, is that every group within that coalition also hates one other group to some extent. Yes. So it's just, it's destined to fail, which is, you know, good for us.
It can't work.
It's one of the things I like to bring up a lot is that, you know, people want to talk about racism in America. Racism is such a problem in America. I'm like, have you ever talked to a Chinese person about black people? Like, do you know how they feel about black people?
Well, the one test is, if you, okay, if, I would ask a liberalist in good faith, pick a white guy from the South or an African immigrant. Who do you think is more racist against black people? And 10 times out of 10, it's a black immigrant. Like, I would say 99% of racism I've heard against black people has been from other black people.
Yeah.
And it's sort of that with every race. Like, every race is more self-critical than it's just weird to, like, I don't know, in this country, it's just so not visibly happening.
They have a term for it as well, of colorism. And we have.
Yes.
Yeah. We had a guest on who spoke about this, Alexia Williams, and she got canceled for ranting against the masks and the shots and all that stuff. But she's married to a white man, and she herself is into things and music and stuff that is stereotypically more white, whereas her white husband is into things that are more stereotypically black, you know, rap music and that sort of thing. And she talks about facing racism from her own people that she grew up with, family members, you know, for not being black enough.
I've noticed, if you ever see a photo, like, on social media of, like, a famous black person or famous white person and their significant other is the opposite race, all the anti-comments are from black people.
Yeah.
Almost all of them. Like, there's no anti-race. All the white people are like, yeah, congrats. All the black people are against it.
This reminds me of one of the big leaks that Project Veritas put out. I think it was in 2001 in the summer. Of Charlie Chester, I think he was from a worker from CNN.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things he
2021.
Talked, 2021, yeah.
You said 2001.
Oh, sorry.
Like, that was a little before.
So he, you know, they put out this leak of this guy undercover basically admitting that, you know, first of all, they were putting the COVID numbers up deliberately because they knew.
I think I remember this one. Yeah.
They wouldn't get views.
But gangbusters with the ratings.
Gangbusters with the ratings, yeah. And, you know, they talked about the coverage of Trump as well. But they also, one of the things they revealed was that they knew that most of the hate crimes that were being committed against Asians were by black folks, and that they deliberately downplayed that because it didn't play into the Black Lives Matter narrative.
The holy black, the magic black African. So, it's their favorite trope.
It's like, they know.
Well, the new excuse is that they would just be influenced by white supremacy or something.
Yeah,
so that, right. They have an out. They have an out.
I mean, you look at Africa today, lots of black people really kind of killing each other, you know.
Well, that's okay. So that's the sort of thing to most liberal arguments is just look at, is sort of the plagiarist kind of soul. It's just a sort of, well, compare it to what? So you what is a black people are oppressed in America? Well, okay, there are certain things that count against them, but as a whole, of the sum of all experiences, would you rather live in America or any African country? And I mean, there are some North African countries maybe in some areas, but I think 100% of people will say no. And here's the thing. These are countries you could move to and retire to on like $3,000 a year. So if it really was preferable, you would have expected it to happen already. So it doesn't mean there's not little things we should work on, but it's just as a whole, we're doing pretty good.
And
listen, if there is racism in the country, it's just we're not the group doing it. That's my point.
And I mean, it's white people have been working. We had a big moment in the 90s where we sort of understood that racism was bad.
Yeah.
Colorblindness was this idea that you were trying to see people as people and not so much see the race.
Mm-hmm.
And then the crazy progressives came along and they said, no, that's wrong. Yeah. You must see race. You have to see them that. Because if you're not actively anti-racist, then you're actually a racist.
Well,
and it's like,
their argument is that by not seeing color,
by not being racist, you're racist.
Well, they're arguing that by not seeing color, you're not recognizing the unique experience.
Right. But see, that's colorful language describing racism.
Oh god, I saw what's his head from a Daily Show, Trevor Noah. I hate him. He was such an asshole. So someone said to him, like, I'm colorblind, and he comes back with, he goes, well, what do you do when you're at a traffic light then?
What?
Yeah, yeah, that was his response. Like, he was taking it literally. I'm like, yeah, I'm like, I get you're trying to be funny, but this was
dumb. He's not funny.
That's not funny. I don't, it's so stupid. He's like, why are you pretending to not know what that means?
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's absurd. Well,
it's a disingenuous, right? It's a correct. Disingenuous yeah. inversion of, you know, this is the, like, we understand that colorblindness in terms of race means you don't see people in terms of the color, not that you're literally colorblind.
Yeah.
There are things that liberals do where they're like, they'll virtue signal their own mental retardation to fit into an in-group. Like, you're doing this thing yesterday where they're like, hey, you know Nikki Haley? She's trying to hide the fact that she's Indian, but her real name is, like, Nimarada. And I'm like, do you really think there's a single person who doesn't know she's Indian? Like, that was the first thing out of her mouth.
Right.
You can go over Washington and going, well, she just admitted it, but her first name's Nikki. Maybe she was lying. Like, what's the theory? So everyone was pointing out. So there was some lady at CNN who's complaining about it. And then someone pointed out and was like, well, no, Nikki's her middle name. By the way, what's your first name? Because this person also had, like, an Indian name. Or I think it was, like, I can't remember her name, it's the CNN woman. But it turned out she, too, had an ethnic name, was using her middle name as her first name. So she then changed her screen name within, like, 5 minutes of being called out. I don't know, but how does the – and it was the same woman who – I know this makes no sense to anyone listening to the podcast. There was, I caught her, like, a year prior. She was, like, complaining about how there was a photo of Ivanka Trump where she was posing for it sideways. And I'm not kidding, this woman's profile picture. So it's just like this weird thing where I'm like, how are the what in your head is not connected?
It's so it's
you're the same person. You're doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, they get that by projection. They do that a lot.
It is projection. Yeah, and every article I've read about Nikki Haley mentions her Indian background and her
She's the right-wing version of a social justice war. She's doing the whole, the left's afraid of an immigrant female shtick, which isn't going to work, by the way.
And also, like, it's funny because her name came up because Don Lemon was like, she's past her prime. Like, I agree with Don Lemon. She is past her prime. She's, you know, in her 50s, you know, and also, like, she's been the governor of South Carolina. She was the United States ambassador to the UN. She's past that. She's not going to be in those high status
positions. Yeah, it's just so funny because the context she said it was basically she's not hot anymore. Like,
right.
If he had said something, like if he had phrased it any other way, but we don't know what he meant because obviously Biden's 80, so you know he's clearly past his prime. You know, it's a weird thing. Like, and then I just love this morning he's not on the show.
Yeah.
You know, it's what went down there.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, I'm still waiting to see what happens with the lawsuit of Mr. Lemon for...
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Was that a sexual thing?
Yeah, I think he, like, shoved his hand down his pants and then across someone's face or some bartender. Oh, that's the story, by the way. Yeah, he's got... And it's not just one. There's a couple different allegations against him.
Interesting.
So, yeah, he's an interesting character, that Mr. Don Lemon.
I feel like it's required you have a sexual harassment scandal if you're a public figure to that extent. Who doesn't have one at this point? It's horrible.
My thinking is that a lot of these very public, very well-funded individuals have cluster B personality disorders.
Well, that's the thing. Like, when you're in a job like that, like like either a movie star or that kind of job, like there's 350 million people in this country, and there's probably less than 1,000 jobs like that.
Yep.
And not only that, if you're one of those people, your whole life that's been your fantasy. And for the other million people that have that fantasy, they just went along with their lives and went, well, that's not going to happen. But from your perspective, it's like, wow, everything really led up to this. I really got power and I can really do anything. And it turns out you really can't do anything. You can't, you know, get away with that. But I wonder, that was kind of my theory. Or it's just people who have those kind of personalities are more likely to gravitate and move up into those positions.
I think it's both, yeah.
That could be, I think CEOs have sociopathy at a very high rate. So, you know, I think it's probably causing the success maybe, but
there was actually a series of articles a few years ago where they were talking about the benefits of psychopathy.
Well, so there it's a net negative, but like there are niche cases where it's good for business, where it's like, suppose you're in a position where it's like, okay, my options are firing 100 people before Christmas or the company fails and we lose 1,000 people. Anyone realizes what you got to do, but only a sociopath is really going to be able to actually do it, which is, you know, unfortunate for every other decision in the company, I guess. But there are little benefits here and there, I suppose.
I think you could have like a CEO or a boss or someone who can do it, but they're going
to
just...
You have to compartmentalize it to a certain extent and go, this is horrible, but it's the greater good and all that kind of stuff. I wouldn't be able to do it. I don't
think. The psychopath, they don't feel anything at all. Correct. So yes, it's much easier for them to do, to do things it. Like that.
And Lobachevsky talks in Political Ponerology, he talks about how over time, when a country starts to get possessed by these pathological personalities, it's like it's an exponential effect. It has a positive reinforcement mechanism because the more of them there are in an organization or in an administration, the more that's going to repel normal people. They're going to be like, "Oh, these people are crazy. I don't want anything to do with this." And it's going to attract other crazy.
So like,
and they'll put them in. And that's kind of, I feel like, what we see almost with George Soros here. It's like he knows sort of which ones will do the chaos thing that will net him whatever he wants as an end goal. And so he's just sort of like picking them out. And it's like you said, there's no sort of like written down communicated conspiracy. Mm-hmm. He's just picking people who by their very nature will do what, you know, he wants done. He doesn't have
The crazy, as you just said, the crazy breeds crazy. They replace the office with nut jobs. And if you and I were to go get a law job and we walk in and it's all pink haired freaks, we're going to go, all right, I'll go be a corporate lawyer at this point. Like, it's self-fulfilling. Like, that's kind of the whole thing with big tech too. Like, is it that there's this conspiracy against conservatives, or is it just once, an institution becomes so liberal, it becomes impossible to have any sort of dissent. So conservatives just go, why would I want to work with those people? True. Which is kind of like, that's the reason I wouldn't. It's just, I don't want to be around them, so I'm not going to. And
that's probably what's also happening in the education system as well. The
same 100%.
You know, a lot of those teachers who want to be more open-minded or simply just don't want to push any indoctrination on students.
Get pushed out
because they're tired of being in that environment. Plus, it's very clicky. Like, I've worked in schools before. It is like that. You know, they have their own little cliques. And when it's like that and they're all just liberal minded,
the way we educate our kids is wrong.
It is dumb.
There's nothing normal or natural about taking a bunch of kids from separate families, segregating them by age, and then putting one adult in front of like 30, you know, of them, give or take.
And men and women learn way differently. Like, there's a whole thing about psychology where, like, I'm one of those people who's like, you know, usually diversity for diversity's sake accomplishes nothing. But there are very niche examples. And one would be, like, in psychology, 90% of psychologists are women. So if they're treating men, there are certain male behaviors that are going to get written up as abnormal that are actually just normal, and you wouldn't know it from a human perspective. So, you know, that's an area where diversity could actually help, is in that. But my relevance to education is it is generally for female audience. Women are way better at sitting and doing work than boys are. We like to run around more. We're more rambunctious. We're more prone to what they call ADHD, which in many cases could just be boyish behavior that should be, you know, through a different outlet. That's another problem.
As you go up in the grades, you find more men, especially college professors and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But the lower you go in the grades, like, I remember, you know, man, there was like a lot of schools that I worked at when I was a sub. Mm-hmm. Kindergarten, preschool, first grade, second grade, third grade. There were almost no male teachers.
But I got to be honest.
Biologically, women are
can't
more.
Deal with it.
I got to be honest, though. If I walk into a preschool with my kid who doesn't exist yet, and I see a male teacher, no offense, I'm sure you're doing a great job, but I don't want you near my kid. It's just a little weird. Like,
why does this adult male want to be around?
And here's the thing. I know it's just dumb bias in my mind because it's so abnormal. Like, if it was 50-50, no one would think about it. But just being the one guy, I'm like, what? Someone's off there. Someone's off.
Well, I mean,
I'm probably a bigot.
Extremely small children are very annoying.
That is true.
There will be outliers, though, because, you know, from like the Big Five personality test and that sort of thing.
There will be, but
there are men who have more of like a feminine type personality. Well, and there are women who have more.
So I just rang the door and I have to give my package.
Go for it.
One second. Just cut it.
No, we can cut that.
53.
Yeah, so we'll.
I thought I heard a doorbell.
Do you want to bring up maybe one more of the articles and we can wrap it up?
Yeah, we're close to the time. What do you wanna? Which one do you want?
I don't know. Which one did we talk about?
I mean, this is a good one to end on.
Okay. That one's more recent too, right?
I think that's the last one in the series. This is 26. This is 26.
Oh, you put 70. Two out on the same.
Put two on the same day. Yeah. So this talks about his investment into education.
Well, that's good. We were just talking about that, so we
can okay, we could dip into that, and then maybe we'll go through.
Sorry, I still got the last guy's mail.
No, that's
it's no biggie.
Every month I had to text him, like, hey, your mail keeps coming here.
I hate that.
For formal episodes, we pre-record them, although we do live streams sometimes, yeah. And those are a little more, like, chaotic, and usually they're, like, round table discussions mm-hmm. where we bring a bunch of people on. But formal episodes, we don't want to have a chat involved or anything like that. Yeah. We like it to just be between us.
Yeah, I can't stand monitoring chat to. If well, we're actually having a serious conversation.
Well, chats participate, too, in the discussion, right, so the they chat joins in, it, so it's like... When it's just a formal thing with us and a guest, I want it to be concentrated.
I like when I was in Tim Pool's show, I was reading the chat and it was like, someone would be like, this guy is great. And the next comment would be like, this guy's a stupid face.
Yeah, Tim Pool's man. Something, it's very interesting to observe. It's a phenomenon in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a back to back best guest ever and worst guest ever. Next week. And I'm like, was this the same person doing a joke? It was very bizarre timing.
That's so funny.
I didn't read the comments.
Yeah.
So let's get back to a couple. We got.
Oh yeah, of course.
Here.
Yeah.
We want to talk about.
I thought like 10 or so minutes before I'm going to run out, but.
Right. Good. Well, so this one you were talking about how he influences education.
Yeah, we were just talking about education.
Oh yeah. So
it's not liberal enough.
Yeah. Well, that's the irony. Like when I was writing the chapter and all the things he funds, I'm like, the only counter argument to this is that this is what a lot of colleges are sort of doing already. I just thought one of the takeaways is just that there are these dozens of schools, and some of them are U.S.-based, but a lot internationally, that sort of have partnerships or, you know, the equivalent of, like, being a sister school with one another. And then there are schools Soros has founded, like Central European University.
Yeah, I didn't even know that.
He founded his own college. And it's one of those things where there's, like, the faculty-to-student ratio is so low. It's clearly just, like, a think tank for Soros that also offers degrees. But yeah, it's just any sort of cartoonish thing you can imagine he's funding at the college level. He's very ingrained with Bard College. I think actually his wife has a like an art or her own office there. Central European University, which I just mentioned, they have their own archive of like just random documents. And it's named after Antony Blinken, our Secretary of State's parents, because they are Soros donors. So there's little tie-ins you find just in researching of like, wait a second, I think that building is named after someone we know and just stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I also, when you mentioned Blinken, what tings my memory is his dad was also connected to Ghislaine Maxwell's father.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, they go back. So it's, I think it's even true that Antony Blinken and Ghislaine were hanging out as children. Because their parents were close together. I think
they should do a sequel.
Yeah, well, the Epstein connection is fascinating.
Yeah, on that note, though, I guess the last thing we'll talk about is maybe you can talk a bit about your upcoming book, which comes out on July 18th, mm-hmm. Fact Checking the Fact Checkers. What's this one all about? What inspired this one? Does any of it have to do with some of the things that you dug up researching Soros?
Yeah, so when I was writing the book, I mentioned myself earlier about Soros funding fact checkers. So there was a time when like Facebook in Central Europe had, I think, 16 approved fact checkers that they would use, and 15 of the 16 were funded or founded by Soros.
Wow.
So he has a lot of influence there. But then the Poynter Institute, which is PolitiFact's parent, has received hundreds of thousands from Soros. And as I said, there are dozens of Soros-related fact checks, and all of them are really just PR for him. The book sort of takes, I wanted to do it in two parts. So I started writing it as just rapid fire essays of here is every dumb fact checker screw up I can possibly find. I had a lot of help. I mean, here's the thing. Most of the stuff they fact check is innocuous. Like, okay, there was a Bigfoot sighting. You're not going to find an error in that. So it just kind of became a game of like, I have to categorize thousands of articles by their headline, what I think is going to be the most likely to produce false content, and then spend hundreds of hours reading every single possible one and looking up every statistic. And it just sort of got to a point where I realized that it's not even that complicated because these people are that incompetent. So they'll take like someone right out of high school or right out of college and put them in charge of fact-checking everything from foreign policy to economics to international affairs. And just having a marginal economics background, like I can just read something and go, you don't know the difference between the debt and the deficit. Or like, like there was one thing where the guy was trying to, like, it was one of those stats, like, you know, so-and-so president added more debt in 1 year than the prior did in the X amount of years combined. And he didn't know you need to adjust for inflation when comparing those things. And the correct thing is to adjust for like how they are relative to GDP, but just stuff like that. Or there are inconsistent standards. So there was a time when Ron Paul, Republican, former Republican, but Libertarian, ran for president countless times. And he said on the debate stage, there was no income tax before 1916, which is true. There was no tax directly on income.
Right.
But what if access to this is false because there are other taxes and people had incomes, so therefore there's an income tax.
Yeah. That's what they do.
Okay, but here's the thing. Jim Webb, a Democrat, says before 1916, there was an income tax. They said it was true. Only difference, one's a Republican, one's a Democrat. When a Republican says that it's false and they come up with an excuse, a Democrat says that it's true. Another example. So I did a whole set. You guys might remember this back in middle of last year. So the definition of a recession usually is, or as commonly defined, is two negative quarters of GDP growth back to back. The economy shrinks for 6 months straight. So first 3 months of 2022 go by, the economy shrinks. We're right at the cusp of the second quarter ending, and it's pretty obvious that it's going to be negative. So ahead of that happening, there's this strange fact checker revelation of, actually, this is an unofficial definition. It doesn't mean it's really in a recession. Now, what's the point of them doing that? Well, the point of them doing that is when there is reporting, it is inevitable it's going to get phrased as, second quarter of growth comes in, the definition of a recession. Well, if that gets reported, now a fact check label goes in those articles and says, well, actually, that's not true. And it's one of those things where the fact checker is sort of technically correct in that we don't have an official definition of a recession, but when we've been using the past one for a century, I would say it does. So when I got creative in that essay, and I'm not kidding, every single fact checker who made the argument of it's not really that definition, within the past 2 years themselves used that definition. So there was one fact checker who debunked a conservative, claimed to debunk a conservative, saying we were in a recession. I found an essay from him where Trump had falsely claimed the last year of Obama we saw a recession. And why did they say Trump was lying? Well, there wasn't two negative quarters of growth. Now, fast forward 2 years, this guy is saying two quarters of negative growth isn't a recession. So that is, I'm not kidding, the book's 100,000 words. That's the entire book. Just back to back, these people have no idea what they're doing. And actually, not the whole book. The first third is just kind of why does this matter? So it's just a history of social media censorship and how it's not enforced really fairly. And then it's just a summarization of studies showing like, no, here's how we know they treat people of different parties differently. And, you know, the challenge of the book is to prove like, well, they're not 90% anti-Republican because 90% tell 90% of the lies. I'm really conclusively proving, no, they literally will change their standards of evidence depending on who makes the claim.
Right. Yeah. They'll also put, you know, they it's very manipulative. They'll put fact check labels on something that is actually, for the most part, true.
True. Yeah.
But they'll find one little thing that's inaccurate just so they can put the label on there.
Oh,
they know most people aren't going to click that and read it. They just see a fact check. Oh, this must be bullshit. So they move on. They're like,
there's a chapter in the book called Fact Checkers Versus Our Eyes and Ears. And it's in that theme. So there was one where I think Biden, and he eulogized Robert Byrd, who was a former, I think, Exalted Cyclops was his title. So anyway, what they did was they found someone who said he was a grand wizard of the KKK. So they debunked that and said, no, it's false. He actually was Exalted Cyclops. Therefore, it's not true that Biden eulogized the Klansman. And I'm like,
wow.
And I'm like, but here's the thing too, is one of the ways you know they're digging is there will be a claim that a politician makes, and they'll, as I said, find a 99.9% similar but slightly different version of it to debunk. And there were some times where I'd click, like, to see where they're getting this from, and it would be like a Facebook page with the screen name like ZX1958 with three followers. And I'm like, so you're digging, and they'll use that fact check to then disprove the actual claim. And as you said, the also big part of the motivation is no one reads past the headline. Yeah. So they just go, oh, that happened. No, because it didn't happen. Oh, well.
Yeah. So. And then they're consistent, you know, their worldview is reaffirmed.
Correct.
and the lie is even more inculcated. Yeah, and then they'll even take that lie and they'll paste it on Twitter or on Facebook and be like, oh no, you're wrong.
What tipped me off to this it was like 10 years ago, before I knew anything really about politics, I was looking for podcasts to download to learn more. And the PolitiFact, I knew from their website, they said they were nonpartisan, but I was reading like the Apple reviews and every comment was like some variant of like, they do a great job of owning these right-wing lies and stuff and exposing the right. And I'm like, that's weird. Like, I wonder why they would disproportionately do that. And, you know, there's really no question why.
We saw a huge increase in this phenomenon during COVID pandemic and the lockdowns, right? Yeah. And the vaccines related to that stuff. And for the 2020 election, you know, I had never seen more fact check labels on things before that period than I did after.
And there are still things about those two events that you're not allowed to say on YouTube. Right.
Well, with Trump, the Washington Post infamously did like, it was like a database of 20,000 Trump lies. And like, so I went through a couple hundred of them because I don't know, I'm not going to go through 20,000, but I think that was a good enough sample. And the way they got that number, they would repeat fact checks. So if Trump says something hyperbolic at a rally, it repeated at 30 rallies, they count it at 30. There was one fact check of a claim where Trump, this is my favorite one of all time, by the way. It was during government shutdown, he hosted an event for like NBA players. And there's this very iconic photo of Trump in front of a platter at McDonald's with his hands in the air. We all remember it. So Trump at that event said some comment like, you know, I bet if you stacked every hamburger here, they'd reach the moon. Well, as it turns out, fact check, there were not enough hamburgers to reach hundreds of miles into the atmosphere and then hit the moon. So thank God we got that as one of the.
You can't even speak in hyperbole anymore.
That's the thing. He might have said a mile high, to be fair, but it was. Come on, there are so many things too in the list where I'm like, these are inside jokes you're missing. Like, we all get it's a joke when he says this, and apparently you don't. But yeah, so that these are they will. The demand for falsehoods exceeds the supply by quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, then this is what they lie by semantic redefinition, right? They call something a fact check when it's not.
Yeah. It's an opinion check.
Basically just opinion. You know, it's just
there was one just coming to mind as we talk because you're describing their tactics. Like there was one category I called true but irrelevant, where they'll admit something is true then dismiss it. So like Ted Cruz said like. You know, our national debt is, or no, what was it? He said, no, our tax code has more words than the Bible, you know, and then their fact check goes, well, it's true, but I mean, who is to say the Bible is the perfect length document? I'm like, what?
It's like they're intentionally dodging his point.
Correct. Yeah.
So they know if that fact check appears there, people will dismiss the point.
But that's the thing; it's just the logo is like a scarlet letter for some people, and
it's just so ironic that they use fact checks to lie.
Yeah,
it's very.
But it's also brilliant because it's all the left is just things that sound good on paper. It's like, and so they can then morally gaslight you.
And they're big. They love that gaslighting. They love projection. They love to lie. I mean, the Republicans do it too. The conservatives are not perfect, but less.
And the thing is, they are never happy. There was this tragic case in the UK where some transgender woman was murdered. And so the articles about it didn't actually say transgender woman. They just said woman. And they were complaining that it didn't say trans woman because it erased their trans identity. And I'm like, but isn't your whole shtick that you're really women? So now that they're calling you that, you're bitching about it? Like, here's the problem with the left. If you're watching this, I don't know what you want. I have not the slightest clue what you
think they want. They don't know
what they want. At all.
Yeah. They want to be miserable. That's what it is.
That's actually it. Yeah.
And they want to make
someone said it perfectly. These are deformed freak losers, and the ideology is window dressing.
Great point to end on. Thank you, Matt, so much for joining us.
It was a lot of fun.
Everybody know where they can find you on Twitter.
So I'm on MattPalumbo12, but apparently there's no engagement on Twitter anymore, so you're not going to see my tweets. But if you want to try to, I'm there.
You got to pay for it. Do you have a verified?
Well, everyone did the whole locking their account thing. I don't think it worked, but maybe I'll try that.
I didn't bother doing that. I'm just
I'm a non-conformist, so I thought once everyone undoes it, then I'll
Then you'll try it.
Yeah, then I'll try it.
Clever.
All right, everybody, go follow Matt and read his articles in the New York Post and keep an eye out for the fact-checking book and take out the George Soros book if you want to read about George Soros.
Yeah, Man Behind the Curtain. Don't miss it.
And don't forget to like, subscribe, comment, give us your money. We love you. Stay safe. Yeah. Stay sane. Bye-bye.
Later.